Welcome to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library Citizen Soldier, Faces of War, documenting the Vietnam War from the front lines.
Authorized by President John F. Kennedy in 1962, the Department of the Army Special Photographic Office, or DASPO, was the Army's photography and film unit. Although it boasted units in the United States and around the world, DASPO's most notable service was in documenting the Vietnam War. With nearly unlimited access to all areas of the American warfront, the individuals of DASPO captured photos and films of combat, troop movements and maneuvers, military equipment, and interactions with Vietnamese civilians. In conducting their work, they often faced the same difficult and dangerous conditions as combat soldiers. Yet, in order to carry as much photography equipment as possible, it usually meant that they would forego carrying a weapon or even water, leaving the soldiers unarmed and extremely vulnerable. Operating out of American Central Command in Saigon, DASPO Vietnam teams included a commanding officer and 10 to 20 sound specialists, motion picture cameramen, and still photographers. Though they traveled with up to 80 pounds of cameras, film, and other equipment, DASPO teams were required to be highly nimble and adaptive, able to travel anywhere in a moment's notice to document events as they happen. Although they were tasked with recording military operations, the photographers and film specialists who followed combat units through swamps, jungles, and villages also captured soldiers' experiences, revealing both the humanity and the horror of combat. Arguably, DASPO's most important legacy was their contribution of some of the most striking and iconic images of American consciousness from the Vietnam War. Although their images were intended for officials at the Pentagon, the Army, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Congress, the dedicated efforts of DASPO's photographers and film technicians ultimately brought the war into civilian homes through televisions and newspapers across the United States. While this was an extraordinarily important public service, allowing Americans to viscerally experience the war as never before, it also contributed to heightened awareness of the war on the home front, and in some cases gave anti-war opposition searing visual representations of what they believed was an unjustified and immoral conflict. Overall, the photographers and film techs of DASPO captured some of the war's most iconic and honest images of American heroism, sacrifice, and conflict, and demonstrated the important role of technology on the battlefield. In bringing the war alive in all its humanity and horror, DASPO set a new standard for visualizing military conflict that still influences how we think about the Vietnam War today.
Joining me today are three veterans of the Vietnam War, an officer, a photographer, and a motion picture cameraman who served with DASPO's Pacific Detachment in the late 1960s. Bill Sanhamel is a former captain in the U.S. Army. During his distinguished military career, Bill served as acting director of administration for the U.S. Army Photo Agency, MOPIC photo officer with the 221st Signal Company, and as a pictorial unit commander and motion picture director for DASPO's Pacific Detachment. Ted Acheson is a former motion picture cameraman with DASPO. Named Cinematographer of the Year in 1969 by the Department of Defense and the National Press Photographers Association, Acheson's work appeared frequently on the nightly news segments in the U.S. throughout the war. Dick Durrance is a former U.S. Army specialist who served 2 years as a DASPO photographer in Vietnam. Dick later joined the staff of National Geographic and went on to a successful career in corporate and advertising photography. Welcome, gentlemen. So, Bill, you were the officer in charge in Vietnam. Why don't you tell me a little bit about where DASPO came from?
In the 1880s, the Signal Corps was part of the U.S. Weather Service, and this poor first photographer for the Army was Sergeant George Rice, who was sent up to the Arctic on a scientific expedition. And unfortunately, it took the Navy 2 years to recover these guys. From this terrible climate. He didn't survive, his film did. And that's pretty much where the Army gets started. As time went by, the motion picture technology was developed. And then they said, well, wait a minute, we can do talking movies and we could use that for training. And it evolved, we'll jump to 1962. When General Decker, who was the Chief of Staff of the United States Army at the time, under President John F. Kennedy's administration, They would go and give briefings to President Kennedy on what was the status in Vietnam. And the Air Force, General Curtis LeMay, he would come in with motion pictures, still photographs, and Kennedy would sit there and say, well, you Air Force guys are really doing good. And they came out of the White House, and General Decker was very upset, and he turned to his aide and he said, I'm sick and tired of going into these briefings with President Kennedy, and we don't have anything to show him. I want, right now, a quick response, special operations photo unit put together that can go anywhere in the world on short notice, respond to the Chief of Staff of the Army, and they will be well-equipped. They will have top-secret clearances. They will have the best equipment. And that's what I want done in very, very short order. They put it together. So that's basically how it started.
Tell me a little bit about day one at the villa when you get to Saigon, and who was the one that was telling you how it really actually worked once you got there?
Either every morning or every other morning. We went to the war room at Tan's Nhut Air Force Base, MACV headquarters, and our role there was to get briefed on where the action was, and they had the maps up. Usually we had a major briefing us, and they would say, yeah, it's pretty quiet here, whatever. Go to the next guy, and he'd say, oh, we're going to have a hell of a firefight over here. It's going to probably go down on Thursday. And so, boom, that's where my team's going to go. And then I'd go back to the villa and say, got something going in Hue or wherever it would be, and send them on their way. The other thing was I had to look out for my troops. I had to make sure they were fed, and they had clean sheets and clothes and a place to shower up and that type thing. Transportation, they didn't give us a truck. They didn't give us a Jeep. We had to go steal everything or go to the transportation guy, his transportation company, and give him a case of eggs, and we'd get a Jeep for a couple of months, that type thing. We just bartered. But that was beside the point. That was the least of our problems.
Yeah. I want to turn over to Ted. Ted, you were a MOPIC cameraman, a motion picture cameraman. Why don't you put that into your own words of how that worked and what kind of opportunities you were looking to capture footage?
When I came into Saigon, was right after the Tet Offensive. And Washington was really wanting more and more combat because of what they saw us produce for Tet. And thinking about all the equipment and everything we had to get ready and pack up and take out to the airport and carry. Sometimes we were carrying maybe 70, 80 pounds of equipment because we shot cans of film that were that big and or 100-foot rolls. Plus we had to beg, borrow, and steal sea rations and put those in our backpack. And so we had enough to live on. We had to have enough film to work with. On your mission with a combat group, you'd be carrying that camera because you never knew when some action would take place. You had a 40-pound camera here. We couldn't carry a weapon. There was just no place to put to sling a weapon if you wanted to use it. The other thing was water. I mean, we'd count on the still photographer that was with us to carry some of our gear because their gear was a lot lighter than what we carried. And our water, we couldn't even carry that. Somebody else had to carry it. So if you were separated for 2 hours or 10 hours, you literally had no water because the troops, they weren't going to share their water. I mean, everybody, every man had to be self-sufficient.
Ladies and gentlemen, you just heard it. The still guys carried the MOPIC gun.
I heard that, yeah.
Heard it right here, right now, today.
Help was the word.
Dick, why don't you tell me a little bit about what conditions were like in the field?
Now, nobody's ever said the Army is always rational, okay? And one of the most irrational things that the Army's ever done is issue combat photographers a Rolleiflex camera, which is a twin lens reflex. You don't look at it like this, laying on your belly where you can keep your head down. No, you gotta stand up and look down to see out. Guys, this is not a good idea. We tried doing it this way, but it's upside down and backwards. That didn't work very well. So that part of it wasn't so great. And the truth is that not long after I left, they reissued them Hasselblads, which you could do in a rational way. I knew that I wanted to be a photographer, and I knew I wanted to be a war photographer. Because I, you know, all through college, I was looking at page after page of history books, and virtually all of them were filled with war. And I'm thinking, why? This is irrational. This makes no sense. Why is this so? And so I wanted to be there. I wanted to see it. I wanted to record it and wanted to be able to share it with other people. And this gave me that opportunity.
Why don't you talk a little bit about how you got onto location, wherever you were told to go, and how did you get home?
They were very competent at getting out there. They knew how to hitch a ride on a Huey or a C-130. They'd get there somehow. Whatever it took, they would get there.
Coming back, it was basically the same way, but when you got to Fubai or Da Nang to get back, you really had to be creative. When you fly and go somewhere in Vietnam, we just took it for granted we could go and do anything. Well, the press, which we were issued press passes, we could show it. But we just got on these planes like we knew what we were doing. And
so when you were getting out on the other end of the furthest reach of your final Huey, what then, Dick?
Well, I'll tell you a specific story. On the first day of the Tet Offensive, I was in Da Nang. And so that night, the NVA had overrun parts of the base. They'd exploded up a big ammunition dump, huge fire. First light, the Arvins and the US soldiers pushed them back out through the village. As we were going out through the village, we were seeing the civilian women primarily coming in. Some of them had been hurt, but they'd all been displaced and dislodged by the fighting. And so we went out with them. We got to the far side of this little village on the outskirts of the base, and then everybody headed out into the paddies, and it seemed like that was pretty fruitless stuff. So we turned and headed back through the little village. And all of those people that had been streaming by were nowhere to be seen. It was quiet. I mean, it was deathly still. We went a little further, and then we realized they weren't out there in the paddies. They were in the tunnels down underneath it. Now, have you ever tried to run without touching the ground? So the getting back, and this is the epitome of the issue of getting back. You go out with the units, and then you've got to get yourself back. But it was never as scary as that one.
Bill, why don't you tell me a little bit about what you were observing as the Tet Offensive approached?
I was doing my thing, and I saw in around the Saigon area a buildup. Well, I'm looking, I say, there's something going on here. Why are they building up so many NVA units up on the northeast area by Saigon? It was just treated very nonchalantly. And it's getting more concentrated with Viet Cong and North Vietnam, regular NVA troops. And now I'm convinced that there's something going to happen. Well, we all were kind of aware of Tet was their big celebration. So long story short, Rick Griffith came in, Captain Griffith, to replace me. So I took him in for the briefing, and I said, I want to show you something. I suspect that we're going to have big time trouble in Saigon. And the reason I'm keying in on Saigon is because that's where we worked out of. And in the past, Saigon, I would describe as being relatively safe. I mean, you could go down to a French restaurant on Sunday afternoon and splurge and get a nice French dinner. So we're doing our briefing, and the bottom line, I suppose it's no big secret, that they didn't know what was going on when the Tet thing was being planned. Mm-hmm. I knew it was coming. I later on read that Westmoreland was in denial. And then, of course, we got two guys hit.
Dick, you were there, right?
I was in Da Nang. I stood there and looked at the teletype machines. And they were spitting out reports of where these attacks had taken place. And they were coming and coming. And I was saying, my God, how can you have, and I think they were pretty much battalion-sized units, rising up out of the cellars, and it turned out to be 88 cities. See, I didn't realize that, for instance, that he was seeing this, but nobody else was. And I was just blown away. How can this happen? We don't know about it. And so it became very clear to me at that point that we had not won the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people, because you can't hide 1,000 people in a city, let alone a small town. So, that to me was the turning point.
Each of you has a story about something that you encountered while you were doing your job. Let's start with Ted.
It was actually May 6, 1968, and we were going out in the field with 101st Airborne, B Troop 2nd of the 17th, and we were just covering an action. And the B Troop had been told that there was a few straggling VC that was in this village of Thon La Chu. The village of Thon La Chu, found out later, was the headquarters for the attack at Wei. When we went into that village, it looked like a Hollywood set. Nothing was moving, there was no civilians. You could hear dogs barking off in the distance and some birds. And it's kind of a clue that something's awry here. Yeah. And so we're in, and we finally take a break on the steps of a temple. And about 15, 20 feet away from us, all of a sudden, they open up. And I don't even know how we didn't get hit. So we went and stood behind a chimney or something that had fallen down, and we stayed there. And the still cameraman, I said, look, you've got one of these Rolleiflexes. I said, whatever you do, don't play a John Wayne and jump in one of these bomb craters. Come on with me. Next thing I know, off he goes. Jumps into a bomb crater. So I go into a Buddhist temple, and I'm filming out of the crater holes in this temple, getting a lot of great shots. And after that firefight only took 5 minutes, and we killed 55 NVA. They had fields of fire, interlocking fire, and I'm filming all of this, and 40-some years later, I find out what I was filming. I mean, I knew I was filming combat, but one of the men that was in front of me was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for what he did. And he wiped out about five NVA bunkers. We walked into a regiment.
And nobody knew.
Yeah, nobody knew. And they wasn't even supposed to be there. I mean, they had an aid station there. There was a lot of our guys that were banged up and shot. And so we were taking care of them. I didn't know I was wounded when I walked out. And a guy said, you know, your pant leg is all black and bloody. So took a look at it, or had somebody take a look at it. And then I got a plane to Fubai, where they had a real hospital. And so they sewed me up. And it was a fun ride back. I got hit in the left cheek. And
not this cheek.
Yeah.
Well, you were wounded. You have a Purple Heart for that action.
Well, Dick, you got anything to rival that?
Well, mine was the biggest firefight I was in, which was near Kuchi. And we were just chugging along, and all of a sudden, you know, all hell broke loose. And so I grabbed a picture where I had a couple of the tanks going, you know, and smoke flying and everything. Ran up and got behind the tank. And then I saw this APC and over here, and there was a guy sitting in the back of it. And I ran over there, and here's this guy sitting there with this glassy-eyed look on his face, you know, covered in muck. And so at this point, I had shot 11 rolls of film with my Army camera, and I had, I don't know, half a roll or something on my camera. So I saw the kid get hit and go down, so I ran across there and picked him up and took him back to a trench where there was a medic taking care of him. And I turned around to go, and I felt my pocket, and the 11 rolls of film were gone. It was the best combat stuff I shot the whole time. You know, the images get seared in your mind. They're there, gone.
They're gone.
Well, Bill, you got a story about hanging out the side of a helicopter.
I went to the Pentagon and I met Lieutenant General Kennard, and he was one of the key ingredients of developing helicopter warfare, which obviously was so important. But anyway, so he told me what he wanted in the film, and he assigned me a Lieutenant Colonel as my technical advisor. When you have a technical advisor who is Lieutenant General Kennard's buddy, there's nothing you can't get when you're working with the 1st Air Cap, because General Kennard was like God to those guys. On any given day when I was filming this thing, the colonel and I would go to the ops officer and say, we need 15 or 20 helicopters in the air today. you got any firefights going? And he'd say, well, let me look. You know, he said, we want to get Charlie over here. He's been messing around with us. Yeah, let's do it tomorrow. He threw a bunch of helicopters in the air, I'll tell you. And we were in a major air assault and firefight on the ground. And during that time with the air cab, you spent a lot of time in helicopter because you're in the command ship. And I was with Sergeant Leroy Massey, great guy. I had a gunship out, and we were in the command ship, and we were above all the other choppers. I look out the chopper, I look down, I said, holy mackerel, look at what's going on down there. It was like a football team running their maneuvers, you know, during a given play. These choppers were going like this and doing flip-flops, and it was amazing. So I say to Leroy, hold my belt, I want to get this shot. Oh, no, he says, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. I said, Leroy, grab my belt. So he grabbed my belt, and I'm leaning out there, man, I got a great shot. And that thing won an award that I never saw the award. I should add that during that film, we used the Tyler mount, which you're familiar with. And that was a great piece of equipment for us to have in Vietnam. It was a piece of hardware that you would sit in and you would put your camera with this huge gyro lens thing in there. It steadied it.
Right, like a steady cam now.
Yeah, and you would hang out of the helicopter and control it.
Yeah, you'd have your feet on the skids.
Right, and holding, you're doing with your thumbs, zooming in, zoom out. Yeah. So
we had great equipment.
Oh, we did, yeah.
So I'm gonna start with you, Dick. What is your favorite DASPO image?
My favorite would be the one of the guy sitting in the back of the APC, you know, obviously stunned by the fighting that he's just gone through. And he's sitting there and he's looking out, and behind him are two pipes that look like horns. And it reminded me of a Viking. And it was a profound statement about the fact that since the Peloponnesian Wars, we have different toys, but the fighting is exactly the same as it's always been.
Bill?
I got to go with the little dog. The look on the GI's face in the front of the APC and the look on the dog. And that is my favorite because it says a lot. It's warm. It's got a little humor.
Thank you. Ted?
I think some of the best motion picture I saw was a guy named Frank Salas. Frank Salas was the NCOIC at the beginning of Tet. And they were out getting some Vietnamese, you know, the French bread that the Vietnamese continued to make even for themselves. And all of a sudden, I mean, they just, everything in the world's going on, and bombs and just, Frank says, holy crap. And they drove back to the villa. They got their gear and went out there. And there's an alley. And I don't know the name of this vehicle. It looked kind of like a tank. And it would go down this alley with MPs. Yeah. And it would get so far down, and you could just see all these people run back. And they're dragging dead bodies with them, their own men. So they go down and charge it again. And same thing, and you could see these guys in the last charge where they come around the corner, two of them have been hit in the footage. This guy, Frank Salas, I mean, he put himself at risk many, many times filming this material. I didn't get along with Frank very well, but I thought he was probably one of the bravest men I ever met.
Being in DASPO wasn't always safe, it sounds like. It sounds like there was a lot of risk, and you lost a couple of guys. Which one of you wants to reflect on that?
Rick Ryan, the one that I knew, and Rick and I went to Thailand on our first assignment. He was a good guy, and they were doing a story up at the DMZ. Rick's helicopter went down, and we had two DASPO guys in the chase helicopter filming all of this stuff. And Rick's in there, you know, filming the dials and everything, and machine gun or anti-aircraft gun was hidden in the DMZ where they happened to be. And Rick's chopper crashed and nobody lived. I think about Rick maybe still once a week. He was just an overall good human being, and he was a great photographer as well. We all live with different things and see different things and see other people, you know, go down like that, and it's a terrible thing.
Yeah, thank you. Well, unfortunately, this is all the time we have right now, but I want to thank you for sharing this and everything that you did when you were over in Vietnam and elsewhere. Thank you for your service.
Well, thank you for letting us share.
Yeah. Thank you.